hello, hello. It's time to read the Des Moines Register for this Wednesday, March 13th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Dennis May, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Barb DeHeck. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. And now let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Our statewide AccuWeather forecast calls for a warm day today with sun and areas of high clouds with the winds from the east at 7 to 14 miles per hour. The forecast for Des Moines calls for a high today of 70 degrees with a low of 50, again warm with sun and high clouds. Heavy rain and thunderstorms tonight. And on Thursday, a high of 57 with a low of 36, cooler with a few showers. So today, across the area, it's just going to be warm with sun and areas of high clouds. Turning over now to the front page of today's Des Moines Register and our headlines. From the Iowa poll, Register exclusive since 1943, Iowans split over gender rule for boards. Legislature considering repealing requirements. Also on the front page, closing of Tyson plant will affect everyone in Perry. As city tries to recover from shooting, it suffers a second, quote, disaster of a lifetime. And her defends his assessment of Biden. And here to get us started with today's Des Moines Register is Barb. Take it away, Barb.
Thank you, Dennis. Closing of Tyson plant will affect everyone in Perry. Christy Hupp couldn't sleep Monday night. Hupp's hometown of Perry had just experienced what she called the second disaster of a lifetime in the span of just 2 months, with the announcement of the city's largest employer, Tyson Foods, would shutter its 1,276 employee pork plant at the end of June. The devastating news follows January's shootings at Perry High School that left 3 people dead, including the principal, wounded 6 others, and closed the city's schools for weeks. Iowa U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, speaking to reporters on a call Tuesday from Washington, called Tyson's announcement a great big punch to the gut for the Dallas County city of 8,000. Hupp, the owner of a dog grooming and boarding business, witnessed the effect almost immediately. I had a client, 61 years old, show up yesterday crying, she said. She has worked at Tyson for 20 years and said she doesn't even know how to look for another job. This is going to really hurt the entire community. Those jobs are what keep small businesses growing and thriving. The restless, worried Hupp on Monday night did what she had done after the school tragedy, filled a bin outside her business with dog food, free for anyone who needs it to take home to a hungry pet. I have so many friends that work at Tyson, and I couldn't sleep thinking about what they are going through. Now they have to worry about their kids going back to school and trying to find new jobs, Hupp said, adding that at least those with dogs will have one less thing to be concerned about. She was one of many Perry residents and leaders the Des Moines Register interviewed on Tuesday, who expressed shock and dismay at the Tyson announcements, which came without warning for most. Heather Nahas, Governor Kim Reynolds' communications director, said the state was informed about the plant closure only a short time before the public announcement. But as with the shooting tragedy, some in Perry also conveyed confidence that the city once again will be able to rebound. Among them was local banker Matt McDivitt, past president of Perry Economic Development. The organization's website recalls how, after a meatpacking plant closed in Perry in the mid-1950s, the Iowa Pork Company organized to build a new plant on the now Tyson site in 1962. Oscar Meyer Incorporated bought the plant in 1965. On Christmas Eve, 1988, just as the company was preparing to close the plant, it announced that it would instead sell it to IBP Incorporated and that it would remain in operation. Tyson took over IBP in 2001. Perry has dealt with similar situations in the past, McDivitt said. This is something we can overcome. He pointed to the well-documented shortage of labor across Iowa and the soon-to-be-available workforce in Perry, along with the empty 30,000-square-foot spec-built structure in the city's 350-acre industrial park, state-certified as development-ready, as assets that Perry can leverage in its favor. This community has shown time and time again that we are resilient, he said. We have a lot of brain power to find solutions, a good group of leaders that care a lot about this community. McDivitt said the group's board will meet with city officials soon to discuss options and decide a plan exactly what Tyson's plans are for the plant after it closes in June. But we have a site and we have workers available, so you never know when a prospect is going to show up. McDivitt said the governor's office and Iowa Economic Authority Director Debbie Durham already have offered support to the community. Mayor Dirk Cavanaugh said he had met with Tyson officials to press them about what help the Arkansas company might provide employees and the community. The company had already said it will seek to employ the Perry workforce in some of its other Iowa plants. Quote, our first priority is going to be to help all the employees affected and try to get them back to work, whether it be in Perry or somewhere else, Cavanaugh said. And then we'll assess how we replace jobs that may have moved somewhere else. Key will be finding another company to purchase the 384,300-square-foot plant just west of the city limits, adding that Tyson told him it's not just going to be a shut-the-door-leave-it-alone departure. They will find a buyer, said Cavanaugh, adding that Perry and Iowa Economic Development officials also will work to sell the building. A meatpacking plant would be the best fit for the space and workers' skills, he said, though he's concerned Tyson may balk at selling the building to a direct competitor. If someone else comes in, it could take months to retool the space, he said. Still, we can think of a lot of companies that could use it, he said, noting that with its sizable floor space, the plant could serve as a capacious warehouse. Perry also would like Tyson to provide some sort of severance, not just for the employees, but for the city, he said. We do supply them with a lot of services. They're shutting the doors to save a bunch of money, he said, and the city wants to know if Tyson is willing to give us a little bit of those savings to help us get through this. He said he expected to talk with state economic development officials Tuesday afternoon, opening channels on what they can do. Cavanaugh said it's not just Perry that will suffer from the closure. The economic effects will ripple throughout the region, hitting trucking companies, pork producers, feed suppliers, and others. There's a big trickle-down impact, he said. It will be a topic of major concern for Lou Hoyer, site manager of the Perry Food Pantry. He recalled a past board member always being protective of the $25,000 the organization had in the bank, asking, what would we do if Tyson shut down? Now that the nightmare scenario is coming to pass, Hoyer said his concern is more logistical than financial, pointing to the pantry's cramped quarters on Perry's east side. The food pantry served 509 households and 1,875 individuals last year, he said, adding, we could not handle another 100 households. We would likely need to look at a different mode of distribution. If it does, he will be one of many adaptations for Barry. There are people with whole families that work there. It's going to hurt, said Gracie Danger, owner of the Perry Paint and Glass. While she is trying to remain hopeful, Danger said she fears a mass exodus of workers leaving the town in pursuit of new jobs. So does Bonnie Eichert, a lifelong Perry resident. Quote, my cousin's daughter works there, and she's been there for 15 years, Eichert said. She doesn't know what she's going to do after it closes. Eichert hopes that the plant is bought by a company that can provide those who lose their jobs a second chance. It's rough, it really is, Eichert said. I'd hate for this community to become some sort of ghost town. That's what might happen if there's not another business. Others in the community shared Eichert's view. Vance Sturm, financial advisor and owner of Generations Wealth Advisors in Perry, envisions a wide range of potential negative effects. If the plant doesn't reopen, what are those families going to do, Sturm said. Local businesses are going to hurt, from grocery stores to restaurants. It's going to affect downtown and affect real estate evaluations. The closing of the plant may lead to less funding in local schools because of lower student counts if families decide to move out of the area, he said. I feel bad for the community, he said. We've got to pull together. A couple months ago, we had a devastating event here, and now we're going to have another one. It won't be as devastating emotionally, but financially for families in the cities, it's going to hurt. And in a related story, Grassley says the Tyson plant closure is a punch to the gut for Perry. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley says Tyson Foods' decision to close its Perry pork plant, laying off 1,276 workers, is a great big punch to the gut for the community that already is struggling with the aftermath of fatal shootings at its high school in January. The plant closure, slated for June 28th, is another great big punch to the gut, said Grassley, adding that the town has struggled with murders, drownings, and other problems. Among them, nearly 4 years ago, a Perry student drowned the weekend before she was to graduate from high school. Grassley said he hasn't heard why the Arkansas company closed the plant or what it plans to do to help laid-off workers or the hog producers who have to find a new processor. I want people to know that if there's anything I can do to help, I'll be glad to do it, he said. But I think that probably on most of this economic development stuff, that the state takes the lead. He said he hoped the jobs can be replaced soon. I want to stay on top of it because Perry is hurting. Grassley said he supports the Biden administration's efforts to increase competition in the meatpacking industry, pointing to a recent U.S. Department of Agriculture rule that gives livestock producers stronger protections against deceptive contracts and retaliatory tactics from meatpackers. The USDA, led by former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, also has been awarding grants to independent meat processing startups to add competition to the meatpacking industry. Last year, the agency announced an Iowa company would receive a $25 million grant to build a $450 million beef processing plant in western Iowa. You've heard me say for several years about the necessity of putting more competition into the big four meatpackers, and Tyson is one of those, Grassley said. He said he believes the USDA understands American agriculture and how important it is. But the longtime senator began his comments criticizing President Joe Biden for mentioning U.S. farmers only once in his State of the Union speech. The president, quote, didn't highlight trade either, Grassley said, adding that the country could see an agricultural trade deficit this year of $30.5 billion. It seems to me this is quite an oversight, he said, because 2% of Americans who are farmers feed the other 98%, and I think that will put them high on my totem pole.
In other layoff news, John Deere to lay off about 150 employees from its Ankeny plant. About 150 workers at John Deere's campus in Ankeny are getting laid off. Factory leadership informed some production workers at the John Deere Des Moines Works campus in Ankeny on Friday that they will be indefinitely laid off in April and May, according to a company statement. Each John Deere factory balances the size of its production workforce with the needs of the individual factory to optimize the workforce at each facility, the statement said. Deere spokesperson Dustin Lemon said in an email that the company had no additional comment. Justin Limke, president of the UAW Local 450, the union representing the workers at the Ankeny plant, did not immediately return a phone call seeking comment. The Ankeny site at 825 Southwest Irvindale Drive has about 1,700 employees, including 1,136 in production and maintenance. Workers at the campus manufacture heavy agricultural equipment, including sprayers and cotton pickers. A 139,000 square foot expansion of the plant sprayer facility is expected to be completed this year. Deere also has presented plans to the Ankeny city officials for a new 20,000 square foot lab building. Tyson Foods announced on March 11th that it will permanently close its pork packing plant in Perry, leaving nearly 1,300 workers without a job. The plant is expected to shut down on June 28th. Tyson is Perry's largest employer. And back to the front page. Iowa poll, a register exclusive since 1943. Iowans split over gender rule for boards. Iowans are split in their opinions on whether to repeal the requirement for boards and commissions to have equal numbers of men and women, as a bill to do so awaits Governor Kim Reynolds' desk. 48% of respondents say they oppose repealing the requirement, while 46% say they are in favor. A new Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll finds 5% say they're unsure. Repealing the gender balance requirement is most popular among self-identified Republicans. 55% say they are in favor, while 41% say they are opposed. A majority of self-identified Democrats oppose a repeal, with 33% in favor and 49% opposed. Political independents split most evenly, with 47% in favor and 48% opposed. Men favor the gender balance repeal slightly more than women, but opinions do not widely differ between genders. Among men, 49% say they are in favor of repealing the requirement, 46% say they are opposed, and 4% say they're not sure. Among women, 43% say they are in favor, 50% are opposed, and 6% are not sure. The Iowa poll, conducted by Seltzer & Company, surveyed 804 Iowans from February 25th through the 28th. It has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. Barbara Yarhart, an 85-year-old poll respondent from Keokuk who identifies as an independent, said she isn't wholly supportive of a gender balance requirement, but thinks it is necessary. "I don't think they should have to mandate it," she said. "But if they don't, you know how it is. It's going to be the old boys club." Joe Cotton, a 62-year-old Republican from Dallas Center, is in favor of repealing the gender balance requirement. Quote, "I just think they ought to pick the best people for the job," Cotton said, regardless of gender. The bill sits on Reynolds' desk after passing both the House and Senate in February. Reynolds has not yet signed it into law, but is expected to. Senate File 2096 would end the gender balance requirement for state boards and commissions as well as for local bodies. Republicans have argued the requirement, which is put into place in the 1980s, is outdated and makes it difficult to find applicants for some boards. Gender balance often causes us to eliminate some of the most qualified candidates, and that's the last thing we want to do, said Representative Jane Bloomingdale, Republican from Northwood. "We want the most qualified candidates to fill positions on our boards, on our commissions and councils." Democrats opposing the proposal have said many boards and commissions still lack a full gender balance, and that existing law already allows for flexibility when making appointments. "The world may have changed, but the world still isn't fair," said Senator Sarah Trone Garriott, Democrat from West Des Moines. "Sometimes more qualified women don't get leadership opportunities until that less qualified man is taken out of the equation." Barb?
Hur defends his assessment of Biden. Special Counsel Robert Hur defended his bombshell report on President Joe Biden's handling of classified documents and his explosive commentary on Biden's memory and demeanor to a House Judiciary Committee rearing for a fight. In the February report, Hur did not recommend the Justice Department charge Biden with any crimes, saying the evidence did not establish his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. But the report also described Biden as a well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory and said he couldn't remember important details about his own life. Quote, "What I wrote is what I believe the evidence shows, and what I expect jurors would perceive and believe," Hur told lawmakers Tuesday. "I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly." Hur, a registered Republican, got heat from both sides. Republicans accused him of going too easy on Biden, while Democrats claimed he wanted to get former President Donald Trump reelected so he'd get another plum job. Hur was a top-ranking member of Trump's Justice Department, then a Trump-nominated U.S. attorney. Attorney General Merrick Garland chose him to lead the independent investigation into Biden's handling of classified documents in early 2023 in an attempt to maintain political distance between the Justice Department and the president. GOP lawmakers criticized Hur's determination that he would not be able to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that Biden's actions had been willful. Quote, "Joe Biden broke the law," said House Judiciary Chairman Representative Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio. "Mr. Hur chose not to bring charges," end quote. Jordan accused Biden of deliberately breaking the law by holding on to classified information in his notebooks. Biden's goal in keeping the notebooks, Jordan said, was to burnish his reputation and write a book for which he got an $8 million advance. We did identify evidence supporting those assessments, Herr said. Biden, Jordan said, knew how to protect the documents after his decades-long political career, but, quote, had 8 million reasons to break the rules. Pride and money, Jordan added, the oldest motives in the book, end quote. Her explained that along with assessing the evidence about a person's motives, federal prosecutors must evaluate whether the suspect would probably be convicted at trial. Her concluded a jury would likely find Biden a well-meaning old man who was forgetful. Democrats argued that her depiction of Biden as an elderly man with diminished capacities was inappropriate and politically motivated. Her said he needed to show why he chose not to charge Biden, which made his evaluation of the president's state of mind relevant to the report. The description in the report was necessary and accurate and fair, he said. One thing the special counsel report said was that Biden, quote, did not remember even within several years when his son Beau had died, end quote. That line became a major attack point for Democrats and infuriated the president, who told reporters, how in the hell did he dare raise that? In the transcript of the interview between the president and her, Biden did appear to express confusion over the year of his son's death, asking those present in the room, was that 2015 he had died? Both parties drew frequent comparisons with Trump, who is being charged with crimes related to his handling of classified documents. Representative Jeff Van Drew, Republican of New Jersey, accused the Justice Department of being weaponized against conservatives. The decision to charge Trump, but not Biden, is, quote, glaring double standard, said Representative Tom McClintock, Republican of California. The fact that the only person being prosecuted for this offense happens to be the president's political opponent makes this an unprecedented assault on our democracy. Her is not involved in special counsel Jack Smith's classified documents case against Trump. Democrats pointed to differences between the Biden and Trump cases. Trump obstructed the investigation while Biden cooperated, said Representative Zoe Lofgren, Democrat of California. And unlike Trump, Biden did not consider documents created by others to be his personal property. Trump is charged with allegedly suggesting that his lawyer hide or destroy evidence, instructing aides to hide classified documents, and trying to delete incriminating video. Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, the top Democrat on the Oversight Committee, drew a line between Hur's report and House Republicans' interest in impeaching Biden. Quote, given that this report is so damning in the contrast between Biden and Trump, it is hard for me to see why our colleagues think that this hearing advances their flailing and embarrassing quest to impeach the president, Raskin said. What America sees today is one president who believes in the rule of law and works to protect it, and one who has nothing but contempt for the rule of law and acts solely in pursuit of his own constantly multiplying corrupt schemes. Representative Hank Johnson, Democrat of Georgia, accused her of doing everything he could to get Trump reelected so that her could be appointed as a federal judge. Quote, you used your report to trash and smear President Biden, Johnson said. You knew that would play into the Republicans' narrative that the president is unfit for office because he's senile, end quote. Her denied wanting to become a judge. He spoke over Johnson to stress that the investigation and report weren't partisan. Quote, Congressman, I reject the suggestions you have just made. That is not what happened, Her said. Partisan politics played no part whatsoever in my work, end quote. Attorney General Merrick Garland did not ask him to make any changes to the report, he said.
Going over now to the Metro and Iowa section, we'll start with an article by Lee Rude in Reader's Watchdog. Iowa contractor gets 20 years prison term. Lawson pleads guilty to 4 felony burglary counts. For years, contractor Jeremy Lawson took advantage of numerous customers in Iowa and several other Midwest states, defrauding them out of thousands of dollars for jobs he never completed. But this week, the longtime felon received a stiff prison sentence of 20 years in connection with a crime spree in Bloomfield, where he and another felon burglarized businesses and robbed local Amish while they were in church on a Sunday in March of 2023. Lawson, age 48, and alleged accomplice Michael Diedrich II, broke into several businesses, including Wagler Metals, on Highway 2 Discount Groceries, Midwest Trust Company, and KW Welding, as well as two residences. At one of the homes, according to court documents, a boy and two teen girls, one in a wheelchair, hid in a back bedroom as Lawson and Diedrich broke in. Lawson was sentenced for 4 felony burglary counts, as well as for being a felon in possession of an offensive firearm, under a plea agreement reached with Davis County prosecutors. In July, Diedrich was sentenced to 10 years in prison after being convicted on 4 burglary counts and 1 of control of an offensive weapon by a felon. County Attorney Rick Lynch could not be reached Tuesday for comment, nor could Lawson, who has lived in Bloomfield and nearby Drakesville. Current records show Davis has a decades-long documented history of taking large advances from customers for construction jobs and then walking away. He's been the subject of news stories since a December 2014 watchdog probe found that he and his brother Marvin had racked up criminal convictions, civil court judgments, and allegations of construction fraud and theft in at least 4 counties in Missouri, 4 in Illinois, and 19 in Iowa, including Polk. As a contractor, Lawson's been a top generator of complaints over the past 2 decades to the Iowa Attorney General's Consumer Protection Division, even though a judge barred him in 2015 from taking further advance payments for any construction jobs. In the case that prompted that ruling, Lawson owed more than $102,000 in restitution tied to 25 victims in connection with court action initiated by a consumer protection lawyer in then-Attorney General Tom Miller's office. One of the last times Lawson was imprisoned was after his 6th conviction of OWI in 2018. With 2 sheriff deputies in pursuit, Lawson sped and drove drunk in Davis County, crashing into a stop sign and plowing into a bridge before flipping his Chevy Silverado, according to criminal complaints against him. 2 of the 3 passengers were taken to the hospital. Lawson received a 10-year sentence, but he wasn't imprisoned until he violated probation. He spent only a year behind bars, our Department of Corrections and Attorney or court records show. Davis County Attorney Rick Lynch said the latest convictions are all tied to crimes involving people Lawson victimized. "I think it's a good resolution and it's going to protect society for a while," Lynch said.
Parking at the airport is getting hard to find. Lots are nearly full as busy travel season kicks in. Arrange a carpool for your spring break plans, because parking at the Des Moines International Airport is nearly full. All of economy parking lots are full, and the long-term parking garage is 99% full as of noon Tuesday. Where can I park at the Des Moines Airport? During high-demand seasons for the airport, the Purple Lot is open to the public. It is typically used for rental car parking and is across from the Gray Lot south of the terminal. Parking is offered at a discounted rate of $6 a day and can be paid through a QR code. What is the demand for parking at the Des Moines International Airport? The demand for on-site parking has grown over the last few years. This resulted in the airport constructing a new parking garage, which is set to open in 2025, creating another 1,100 stalls. Last year, the economy gray lot was expanded by 400 stalls to accommodate the demand. But the need for on-site parking continues and is nearly outpacing the expansion, said Kayla Kovarna, Deputy Director of Communications for the Des Moines International Airport. How much does Des Moines Airport parking cost? On-site parking ranges from $7 to $12 a day in the economy lots and includes a shuttle ride to the terminal. The parking garage offers covered parking starting at $20 a day for long-term parking and $48 a day in the hourly spaces. What are tips for parking at the Des Moines International Airport? You can check the status of parking at the airport via the airport parking website page. There are updates for all of the shuttle times, as well as a parking estimator. As of noon Tuesday, all 3 economy lots were 100% full. There were an estimated 19 spaces in the long-term garage and 25 hourly garage spots. That had improved by 2 p.m. when economy lots were listed as 97 to 100% occupied. Numbers are expected to fluctuate frequently. Be sure to arrive at the airport at least 90 minutes early and consider planning extra time for shuttles, Kovarna said. Each shuttle is estimated to take up to 10 minutes, even during peak hours. But Kovarna said it is better to plan for extra time just in case. Base your arrival time at the airport on the boarding time listed on your ticket, not the departure time. Doors to a flight close 10 to 15 minutes before departure, Karana said. Where are the shuttles for the parking at the Des Moines airport? Shuttles continuously run to the gray, red, and blue parking lots at the airport. They are estimated to take up to 10 minutes. You can track each shuttle from the Des Moines International Airport's parking page. How much has the parking demand increased at the Des Moines International Airport? This year has already exceeded the parking peak of 2023, and spring break is expected to continue the trend. The Des Moines International Airport is anticipating an 8 to 10% increase in parking throughout this year's spring break in comparison to 2023. There's also nearly a 10% increase in the number of the seats departing from the Des Moines Airport. Are there other options near the Des Moines International Airport? Keck and Jet offers parking near the airport. Both companies provide a shuttle service to the airport and charge $10 a day. Jet's parking is also full for the next week to 9 days. Keck is at maximum capacity. The best time to park is bright and early. As the morning goes on, there are fewer spots open, said Tom Wiregana, Keck Airport parking manager. High demand would be an understatement, Wiregana said. It isn't unusual for spring break, but we have been full almost every day for the last week. Jet parking is located across the street from the airport. Reservations must be made 72 hours in advance of the reservation. Keck parking, located across the street from the airport, allows reservations to be made 48 hours in advance of the parking date.
Here's a somewhat related article to our lead story on the closure of the Tyson plant in Perry. Iowa's mobile workforce center ready to serve Perry, converted bus, will bring job search tools directly to laid-off Tyson employees. Iowa Workforce Development says it will be deploying its Iowa Works Mobile Workforce Center, introduced late last month, to aid the 1,276 workers expected to lose their jobs in the closing of Tyson Foods Perry's pork plant. The converted bus is a 32-foot-long American Job Center on wheels, providing the same services that were previously possible only in an Iowa Works office. The vehicle serves as an expansion of Iowa's network of 18 Iowa Works offices across the state. Included in the mobile center are 10 computer workstations where staff can assist with job searches and navigating unemployment claims. Staff will be able to use two 40-inch monitors to lead job search workshops or hiring fairs, including one mounted on the outside of the vehicle that can be used for outdoor events during warmer months. The Mobile Workforce Center also includes an Americans with Disabilities Act accessible entrance at the back of the vehicle. Notice of the plant closing, said to be slated for late June, triggers Iowa Workforce Development's rapid response, which includes the use of the new mobile unit, according to Jesse Doherty, spokesperson for the agency. The rapid response involves workers' information meetings and making a number of employee assistance services available in conjunction with the employer, Doherty said. Iowa has experienced labor shortages in recent years, with more jobs open than workers available, but it will still be stressful for those affected by the layoffs, said Joe Henry, political director of the League of United Latin American Citizens, Council 307 in Des Moines. I'm sure there will be opportunities for them to go to other meatpacking facilities, but you know, they have their kids, their families there in Perry, so it will be a disruption, and it's not something where people are going to be willing to move, at least not right away, Henry said. He said LULAC will help the displaced workers, many of them Spanish speakers, where it can. If we can help in providing coordination and information to the folks there, we definitely will. We're just going to need to get more information, he said Monday. He said much of the initial assistance will need to come from the United Food and Commercial Workers, the union representing the workers, but added that the U.S. Department of Agriculture may provide some assistance as well. And a short article here, Des Moines man dies in crash involving motorcycle, SUV. A 50-year-old Des Moines man died due to his injuries in a two-vehicle crash involving a motorcycle and a mid-size SUV Monday afternoon in Des Moines. This is the city's second traffic-related fatality of 2024. According to a news release from the Des Moines Police Department, the motorist of the motorcycle, whose name has been withheld, was traveling eastbound on Army Post Road at high speeds. The SUV had completed a turn into the eastbound lanes of Army Post, which the motorcycle rear-ended. The motorcyclist was then ejected off the motorcycle, the release states. The motorcyclist was transported to a local hospital in critical condition and later died from his injuries, according to the news release. No other individuals were injured. The Des Moines Police Department is investigating the crash.
How to set limits for your kids on social media. In this day and age, the majority of people are on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, or YouTube, even if they might not be adults yet. Attempting to manage a child's use of whatever other app is trending can be overwhelming for parents, so much so that the majority of Iowans support state legislation that would limit children's access to social media. A proposed bill intended to create more oversight on children's internet use for parents and guardians passed the Iowa House on March 6th. House File 2523 bans anyone under 18 years old from making an account on social media platforms like Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok without permission from a guardian or parent. It also allows the Iowa Attorney General and users to sue social media companies for violating parent authorization rules. A recent Des Moines Register-MediaCom Iowa poll found that more than half of Iowans favor the bill, with 42% of Iowans opposed to it. Here are some tips for parents on how to manage kids' time on the Internet. Is government oversight for children's use of social media effective? It can be. State involvement to limit minors' access to social media is an effective tool to improve Internet oversight for children, said Rachel Young, associate professor at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. The implementation of laws that protect children online in other countries has proven effective, Young said. Quote, parents have been given this really pretty impossible task of managing digital media, Young said, who studies how adolescents and parents manage digital media use. So it makes a lot of sense to me why we're seeing a call from parents for help from legislation that would more effectively keep younger kids off social media. What are the dangers of social media for children? Social media companies use algorithms to determine what people want to see based on searches and likes. This can become dangerous for people and children if something like self-harm is searched. If a kid shows some interest in a video talking about self-harm, the TikTok algorithm, or whatever social media platform, will very quickly notice that, Young said. Then you might get a lot of content about self-harm. So you're very quickly in a media environment where you are surrounded by those types of messages. What makes monitoring child social media use so difficult? The sheer volume of content children now have access to on social media makes it hard for parents to monitor. Not everything on the Internet is bad, either, which makes it hard for parents to decipher limits, Young said. It is hard to distinguish between the uses that we want to allow and the uses that we don't, Young said. What is the best way to monitor social media use for children? Talking to children about social media at an early age can help establish boundaries, Young said. The most effective strategy to limiting social media is when kids have a model for having conversations with parents about what they see online. Research shows parents have an easier time setting effective limits if there has been conversations about social media in advance, Young said. If you already have the type of relationship where kids feel open to discussing what they have encountered online, then that will help in setting limits and rules that a kid is more likely to understand, Young said. Hopefully, those limits will be more effective. How effective are limits created by social media companies? Most social media apps have age restrictions when making an account. To access Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter, users must be at least 13 years old. But as we all know, it only takes some simple math for kids to adjust their age to meet the age requirement. Kids have a lot of motivation to use social media because it's where everyone they know is already using it for important conversations, Young said. So it is not difficult at all for kids to get around age limits set by any social media platform. And what tools are there to set limits on social media? Some smartphones allow parents to set time limits on a child's phone or how long they are on a certain app. This can be an effective step for improving Internet oversight for children. If your phone is connected to your child's phone in a family group, then you can have oversight over a lot of how that phone is being used, Young said. Limits can help, but Young believes they should be accompanied by a conversation. Kids are really good at finding ways to get around any limits that parents might set, and they are often very knowledgeable about technology, Young said. If those limits are set in a way that involves the kids and an understanding of why they are important, they might not like it, but that would lead to a better outcome than a limit that is set like a my way or the highway limit.
In Iowa political news, West Des Moines Democrat to run for House District 28 seat. A Democrat from West Des Moines has announced her candidacy to run for an Iowa House seat that represents southwestern West Des Moines, Adel and Van Meter in Dallas County. Laura Snyder, who is an assistant county attorney in Greene County, declared her candidacy on Tuesday for Iowa House District 28. She officially filed March 7th for the June 4th primary election. Former U.S. Representative David Young, a Republican, currently represents the district. As an assistant county attorney, I've seen firsthand how the failure of state lawmakers to act on important issues like mental health and public school fundings leave too many of our kids at risk, Snyder said in a news release from the Iowa House Democrats. I can promise the people of Dallas County that I will show up and always listen to their concerns, Snyder added. Snyder graduated from Drake University Law School and has worked in the public defender's offices of Webster and Story counties. I'm running for the Iowa House because I'm tired of politicians who insist they know what's best for me and my family. Our state continues to take away rights from Iowans, attacking our bodily autonomy, our schools, and our kids, Snyder said. Her platform positions include increasing mental health resources and enacting common sense gun policy. Snyder is a mother and stepmother to three children. Her husband, Chris, is an associate professor at the Drake School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Young of Van Meter represented Iowa's 3rd congressional district between 2015 and 2019 before he lost against Democrat Cindy Axne in 2018 and 2020. Young also was chief of staff for U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley from 2006 to 2013. In November of 2022, Young defeated Democrat Sonia Heitzhusen for the Iowa House District 28 seat. As of Tuesday afternoon, the Iowa Secretary of State's online records did not show that Young had filed for the June 4th primary election. Also in political news, ESA ethics complaint against Iowa lawmaker dismissed. A bipartisan panel of Iowa lawmakers unanimously tossed an ethics complaint Tuesday against Representative Dean Fisher, Republican from Montour, dismissing allegations by a liberal advocacy group that Fisher set up a private school to financially benefit from legislation he voted for. Fisher serves as a founder and the board president of Tama Toledo Christian School, a K-8 private school set to open in 2025. The group, Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, accused him of abusing his public power for private gain, arguing in a February 28th complaint that the school would benefit from Iowa's Education Savings Account program, which he voted for in 2023 on its way to becoming law. In a response written to lawmakers, Fisher called the complaint politically motivated, saying it was based on disagreements about the legislation. The committee sided with Fisher in a unanimous 6-0 decision after a short discussion Tuesday. I don't think that Dean Fisher's personal interest was necessarily the driving force behind the effort to have vouchers for the private school, said Representative Stan Gustafson, a Republican from Norwalk, and Representative Monica Kurth, Democrat from Davenport, said the complaint gave her a bad feeling overall, but didn't believe it rose to the level of violating the ethics code. In a statement, Fisher praised the committee's dismissal of the complaint. It's wrong to attempt to use the mechanisms of government to attack someone you simply disagree with on policy, Fisher said. Fortunately, the ethics committee agrees, and this situation has been resolved.
And turning to national and world news, inflation and price pressures remain up. Consumer prices in the United States picked up last month, a sign that inflation remains a persistent challenge for the Federal Reserve and for President Joe Biden's re-election campaign, both of which are counting on a steady easing of price pressures this year. Prices rose 0.4% from January to February, higher than the previous month's figure of 0.3%, the Labor Department said Tuesday. Compared with a year earlier, consumer prices rose 3.2% last month, above January's 3.1% annual pace. Excluding volatile food and energy prices, so-called core prices also climbed 0.4% from January to February, matching the previous month's rise in a faster pace than is consistent with the Fed's 2% inflation target. Core inflation is watched especially closely because it typically provides a better read of where inflation is likely headed. Quote, it's a disappointment, but not a disaster, said Eric Winograd, U.S. economist at Asset Manager AB. The underlying details are more encouraging than the top-line number, which was boosted by a few volatile categories, the type of prices that tend not to repeat month to month. Those volatile items include gas prices, which jumped 3.8% just from January to February, but are still below their level of a year ago. Airfares surged 3.6% after 2 months of much smaller increases. Clothing prices rose 0.6% after 3 months of declines, but are unchanged compared with a year earlier. Housing and rental costs, which tend to change more slowly, cooled in February. They rose 0.4% from January, slower than the 0.6% increase the previous month. Measures of new apartment leases, which have cooled, will likely feed into the government's inflation data in the coming months. New car prices ticked down 0.1% in February. Though these prices remain much higher than they were before the pandemic, they're expected to decline further as more vehicles show up on dealer lots. Grocery prices were unchanged last month and are up just 1% from a year earlier. Despite February's elevated figures, most economists expect inflation to continue slowly declining this year. At the same time, the uptick last month may underscore the Fed's cautious approach toward interest rate cuts. Voter perceptions of inflation are sure to occupy a central place in this year's presidential election. Despite a healthy job market and a record-high stock market, polls show that many Americans blame Biden for the surge in consumer prices that began in 2021. Though inflationary pressures have significantly eased, average prices remain far above where they stood 3 years ago. In a State of the Union speech last week, Biden highlighted steps he has taken to reduce costs, like capping the price of insulin for Medicare patients. The president also criticized many large companies for engaging in price gouging and so-called shrinkflation, in which a company shrinks the amount of product inside a package rather than raising the price. Too many corporations raise prices to pad their profits, charging more and more for less and less, Biden said. Rob Considine, who lives near Minneapolis, said he has noticed shrinkflation in consumer products like deodorant, shampoo, and soap. Considine, 38, said he doubts, though, that Biden's criticism of shrinkflation or proposals in Congress to restrict the practice will have much effect. If companies can't make bars of soap smaller while charging the same price, Considine suggested, they will simply reduce the quality to maintain their profits. I don't know how government can set a price for a commodity like that without affecting it in the long run, he said. Overall inflation has plummeted from a peak of 9.1% in June 2022, though it's now easing more slowly than it did last spring and summer. The prices of some goods, from appliances to furniture to used cars, are actually falling after clogged supply chains during the pandemic had sent prices soaring higher. There are more new cars on dealer lots and electronics on store shelves. By contrast, prices for dental care, car repairs, and other services are still rising faster than they did before the pandemic. Car insurance has shot higher, reflecting rising costs for repairs and replacement. And after having sharply raised pay for nurses and other in-demand staff, hospitals are passing their higher wage costs on to patients in the form of higher prices. Still, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell signaled in congressional testimony last week that the central bank is getting closer to cutting rates. After meeting in January, Fed officials said in a statement that they needed greater confidence that inflation was steadily falling to their 2% target level. Since then, several of the Fed's policymakers have said they believe prices will keep declining. One reason, they suggested, is that consumers are increasingly pushing back against higher prices by seeking out cheaper alternatives. Most economists expect the Fed's first rate cut to occur in June. When the Fed cuts its benchmark rate, over time it reduces borrowing costs for mortgages, car loans, credit cards, and business loans. Brad Wills, a senior executive at Schneider Electric, a global electronics component manufacturer, said the pressure his company has felt to boost prices is leveling off because supply chains have healed from the disruptions of the pandemic. Schneider manufactures electrical supplies, mostly for homes and apartments. Still, the disruptions of the pandemic have left the company with a higher cost structure than in the past. It brought some manufacturers back to the United States, where it is more expensive, after some of its plants in Mexico shut down during the pandemic. Schneider's also now carries more parts after having dropped a just-in-time approach to inventory that it and many other manufacturers had followed during the pandemic. There are still some pressures, but it's plateauing, Wills said about the inflation and pricing.
A bill aimed at protecting letter carriers. USPS, United States Postal Service, union is seeking to ensure worker safety during mail delivery. When the U.S. Postal Service launched Project Safe Delivery last year, officials pledged they would be, quote, doubling down on their efforts to combat growing rates of letter carrier robberies. The crackdown has led to hundreds of arrests, and robberies slowed toward the end of the year. But overall, the number of postal carriers who were robbed in 2023 rose again, and the number who were injured nearly doubled as criminals continue to target carriers for their antiquated arrow keys that allow access to mailboxes. This week, legislation is being introduced in Congress to accelerate the replacement of tens of thousands of mailbox keys, boost prosecutions, and review sentencing guidelines. All of it can't come soon enough for letter carriers. Quote, "We're like sitting ducks out there," said Houston mail carrier Tijuana Abbott, who accused postal leadership of failing to do enough to address the problem. Enough is enough. Postal carrier robberies climbed to 643 last year, an increase of nearly 30%, and the number of robberies resulting in injuries doubled to 61 last year, according to figures provided by the U.S. Postal Inspection Service in response to a Freedom of Information Act request by the Associated Press. All told, robberies grew sixfold over the past decade, and the number of postal carriers held at gunpoint increased even more, according to an analysis of postal statistics. Under Project Safe Delivery, which was launched last May, there have been more than 1,200 arrests for mail thefts and letter carrier robberies. The Postal Inspection Service also conducted targeted law enforcement surges in trouble spots, including Chicago, San Francisco, and cities across Ohio. The effort also included the deployment of more than 10,000 high-security blue boxes in high-risk locations and the installation of nearly 30,000 electronic locks on mail receptacles. There is a glimmer of hope. Postal robberies dipped 19% over the past 5 months, while arrests for letter carrier robberies grew 73% so far in 2024 fiscal year, said Jeff Adams, Postal Service spokesperson. "We have been unrelenting in our pursuit of criminals who target postal employees and the U.S. mail. The efforts of our postal inspectors and law enforcement partners have yielded positive results," Postmaster General Louis DeJoy said. "We're not done." Postal leaders and letter carrier unions were incensed when a federal judge in San Francisco last month sentenced a man who held a gun to a postal carrier's head to just 30 days behind bars. DeJoy called it unacceptable. The leader of the letter carriers union called it absolutely ludicrous. "Postal carriers should be able to do their job without any concern for someone putting a gun in their face or in any way assaulting them while they're just trying to do their job and deliver to the American people their mail," said U.S. Attorney Kenneth Parker, whose district in southern Ohio dealt with growing postal carrier robberies. In addition to being traumatized for letter carriers, Parker said the robberies represent a threat to democracy because, in addition to envelopes containing personal checks, prescriptions, and other important items, many now use the mail to send in ballots. This week, a bill is expected to be introduced in Congress to appropriate federal dollars to help replace the antiquated keys with electronic versions that have no value to criminals, require all 93 U.S. attorneys to designate a prosecutor for a postal crime, and to review sentencing guidelines for postal crimes, said Brian Renfro, president of the National Association of Letter Carriers. The bipartisan legislation provides resources to protect our dedicated postal service workers while making sure we are punishing criminals to the fullest extent of the law, said Representative Brian Fitzpatrick, Republican from Pennsylvania, the leading sponsor in the House. Jeremiah Grant, a postal carrier in Oklahoma City, was held up in April of 2022 by a man wearing a mask. He clambered to take off his thick leather belt to which his key was attached while a gun was being pointed at him. The gunman also snatched a cell phone and smashed it. Unnerved by the experience, Grant had difficulty sleeping and decided not to go back to his route. Quote, "I'm no longer a letter carrier. I'm a clerk because I don't feel safe going out there," Grant said. "It's not a feeling that I can shake, and it's been almost 2 years now." Abbott, the Houston mail carrier, was a victim of an attempted rape in which she fought off the knife-wielding attacker on her postal route 20 years ago. 10 years later, she was robbed of her arrow key. Abbott worked through the trauma and still delivers mail, but she questions the sincerity of postal officials' efforts to stop crime. "I believe they abandon us. We are getting robbed of the keys, and they're not doing anything about it," she said. "I feel like they don't care." Though unique circumstances led to the 30-day sentence in the San Francisco case, federal laws allow for a sentence of up to 10 years for an assault on a postal worker and up to 25 years for a subsequent offense, officials said. Mail theft carries a penalty of up to 5 years in prison, and possession, concealment, or disposal of property carries a sentence of up to 10 years in prison. We're going to take a look at a couple state shorts here before going into our birthdays today. From Nevada, from Reno, Nevada, a bar crawl, a parade, and a foot race are part of the local St. Patrick's Day festivals this weekend, and the weather looks to be clear and dry for all that and more. In fact, after two chilly weekends in Reno, the biggest little city could hit 70 degrees on Sunday for the first time in years. And in Nebraska, from Omaha, Big Grove Brewery says it plans to open an Omaha tap room next year as it expands its distribution into Nebraska. From New Hampshire, Gather, a nonprofit organization that provides free food to residents in 59 communities in southern New Hampshire, reports in January was the busiest month in its 200-plus year history. According to Gather's executive director, 2023 as a whole saw a notable surge in the number of people seeking food assistance from the nonprofit. From Woodbridge Township in New Jersey, police are investigating after a dog mauled and killed a three-month-old baby boy in northeast New Jersey over the weekend and injured the infant's mother, officials said. Santa Fe, New Mexico. Combined cannabis sales in New Mexico topped $1 billion in New Mexico in February as the two-year anniversary of illegal adult-use cannabis sales in the state approaches. In a news release, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham said the numbers were a huge milestone in the cannabis industry.